Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Every year, The New Yorker convenes a gathering, a festival of people who are pushing the boundaries in every field of endeavor. Performers, artists, thinkers, chefs. And we're going to bring you three of those conversations today. With the political journalist Naomi Klein, the chef and author Yotam Ottolenghi, and the comedian Hasan Minhaj. Minhaj is a veteran of The Daily Show, and when he hosted the White House Correspondents' Dinner last year, he said no one wanted to do this, so of course it lands in the hands of an immigrant. Minhaj himself was born in the United States, but that's hardly the point. He's also in a generation of comedians that's changing the form. Someone starting to push past the need to be funny all the time and land a punchline on every observation. We see that trajectory in Minhaj's autobiographical show called Homecoming King on Netflix. He spoke about it with The New Yorker's Vincent Cunningham, and we'll start with a clip from the special.
When 9/11 happened, I was a sophomore in high school. My dad sits everybody down at the dinner table, and he's like, all right, Hasan, whatever you do, do not tell people you're Muslim, do not talk about politics. I was like, all right, Dad, I'll just hide it, cool. And this just rubs off. We're sitting there, phone rings. I run to the phone, but my dad, he had a good first step, so he beats me to the phone. He's like, dah, dah, hello? I grab the second phone, hello? And I hear a voice, hey! Hey, you sand nigger, where's Osama? He looks at me. You can hear me, right, you dune coon? Where's Osama? He's just like, yabbling it. Hey, you can hear me, right? 263 Nogata Lane, that's where you live, right? I'm gonna f***ing kill you, click. And my dad's looking at me. You ever see your parents and you see the mortality in them? Like, I'm looking at my dad and I see all 5'7" of him. And that's when I realized, no, I'm a dark book. I'm a scaredy cat. You know the way it is. We can speak two languages, garkibate, barkibate. We can speak at home and outside. I should have said something. I didn't. We sit down, I hear foom, foom, foom outside. So me and Dad, we run outside and all the windows on the Camry are smashed in. And I look in the back and my backpack's open. I'm like, they stole my stuff. I reach and I pull out my backpack. But these pieces of glass get caught in my arm. And now all this blood is like gushing down the side of my arm. And I'm pissed. I'm just like mad. Man, this, man. Like, these kids, they know where we live. They're calling us. They're timing this in real time. So they're watching us. So I'm running up and down the cul-de-sac, looking in the trees, the bushes. I look back in the middle of the street. My dad's in the middle of the road, sweeping glass out of the road like he works at like a hate crime barbershop. Just like, oh, man, we got customers. Lokyak gang. We got to clean this up. Zen. Brown Mr. Miyagi, just like not saying a word. I run up to him like, Dad, why aren't you saying something? I'm not asking you, now, say something. He looks at me and he goes, Hasan, ye cheeze to hote? Or ye cheeze hoenge? These things happen, and these things will continue to happen. That's the price we pay for being here. And that's when I was like, oh no, we really are from two different generations. Like, BMX bikes aside. Like, my dad's from that generation, like a lot of immigrants, where he feels like if you come to this country, you pay this thing like the American dream tax, right? Like, you're gonna endure some racism, and if it doesn't cost you your life, well, hey, you lucked out, pay it. There you go, Uncle Sam. But for me, like a lot of us, I was born here. So I actually have the audacity of equality. Like, I'm like, no, I'm an honors gov. I have it right here. Life, liberty, pursuit of happiness.
One of my favorite lines from your special, which we did not see there, is that immigrants love secrets.
Oh, yeah.
And you just talk about how someone keeps something in for 30 years and then all of a sudden it comes out as this big revelation.
Right.
I wonder, like, with that as a backdrop, that being how you grew up, how did you make your way to this kind of work, which is so confessional and so personal? How did you, what made you want to do that?
You know, I started as a sophomore in college. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the material early on was just like, oh, Facebook's weird, right? Like, right? Like, you ever have people with weird status updates? It was real generic sort of stuff. And a lot of it was, you know, really just trying to do everything I can to contextualize commonality with the audience of like, dating's hard, right? Or like, you know. And it's interesting. I had known all of those stories, I just didn't think it would have the right fit in a two-drink minimum comedy club environment. You know what I mean? Like, be like, hey, what'd you guys do on 9/11? And like, sort of like, you guys endure a hate crime? And like, tip your wait staff. Like, it wasn't the right format for it. And I actually sort of hit a wall with just traditional stand-up.
Yeah.
It really wasn't working for me as a medium. And there's a lot of really great comedians that I came up with that are great one-liner comedians, or they're really good at that, and it just wasn't working for me.
Yeah.
And I started pivoting more, and I started going to these things called the Moth Story Slams, and the creative director of the Moth, Catherine Burns, had heard a couple of the stories that I was telling at the slams, and she's like, you should flesh this out into something more. And I started just sort of merging the two of like, hey, I can tell stories and there can be funny moments in it, and then get back into more serious stuff. And so I started shifting the show more into the theater space, and it naturally progressed there, you know?
So is that for you where, because those things come together, the personal, the political, and the comedic come together?
Yeah.
Does the joke start in one of those pockets for you? It's something that you're worried about, and then you're, how can I make this funny? Or is it something that's funny and you don't know why it's funny, so you have to figure out the serious part of it? Where's the genesis of this
stuff? Yeah, so for me, I think one of the things that like helped me a lot, and I was like, oh, I kind of think of things this way, was when I first started at The Daily Show. And I remember walking in and being like, okay, I just have to be funny. And so I would just throw out sort of jokes or quips or asides and be like, oh man, like Mitch McConnell looks like a turtle or whatever.
He does.
But
that's still funny.
But I remember John being like, hey, like, what's your take on it? And your position, that shapes the entire act one.
Right.
So I'll give you an example. So like with the clip that we just saw with Homecoming King, the take is, the difference between me and my dad is my dad believes in this thing called the American Dream Tax, where, yeah, immigrants just go through shit, and if you don't die, well, you're lucky, so be grateful. And my take on it is like, no, like, equality is a right everyone should have. I'm born here. I have the audacity of equality.
Yeah.
And that then shapes the whole, what in that thing is like a 7 or 8 minute story, right? We do the same thing on the show. You have a clear sort of position or take, and then you build comedy around it.
So to go back a bit, what was your relationship to comedy specifically, but also pop culture generally when you were a kid? What were you watching? What kind of made you want to do this stuff?
I mean, believe it or not, I actually didn't really want to do stand-up. I was a big hip-hop head, sneakers, basketball, NBA. Like, that was my thing. I wanted to play in the NBA, and that sort of died in the seventh grade.
Yeah. Seventh grade is where it always happened.
Yeah, where you're just like, oh, man, like, I can't run and touch net. That's a problem. like this is gonna be a huge problem to playing.
Just
in
the waiting on that growth
spurt. And then you like sort of lie to yourself and be like, I could be like a Steve Nash, and you're like, yeah, but I'm just not good enough. and the world is telling me that. But I was actually really big in speech and debate. When I got to college, I was part of that whole Napster Kazaa generation, right? Where people are like,
same.
Oh, do you want to see every episode of South Park ever?
Yeah, yeah.
And you're like, that's a thing? Like, we can do that? How is that possible? Right?
Totally illegal,
yeah,
turns out.
And it,
not
yeah,
good. Yeah.
And that's how I first saw stand-up comedy. Like, I first saw it in its real sort of form. I used to think that, like, oh, it's the shitty part of Seinfeld. You know, at the beginning of Seinfeld?
and he's like,
what's the deal? Yeah, with laundry. And I'm like, no, get to the show. Like, get to the show. So when I went to my friend's apartment, he was like, oh, I'm watching stand-up. I'm like, ah, it's the worst. That's the worst part of Seinfeld. And he's like, no, watch this. And so this actually wasn't that long ago. It was Chris Rock's Never Scared. So it was a special that came out in 2004. I was a sophomore in college. And I remember seeing him talk about like the war in Iraq and like really stuff that was like really powerful. And I was like, oh, that's just funny speech and debate.
Right.
And that like clicked for me. I was like, oh, I should try to do something like that. Because when I was in high school and I would do speech and debate, whenever I would have to argue a position or point, if I made the judges laugh, I automatically saw like an increase in the amount of points that I would get, you know?
Right.
And so I was like, oh, that's like a really powerful tool to get people on your side.
Yeah. So it sounds like that for you, maybe politics predated comedy.
Right.
Because like you talk about in the special, it's 9/11 was of course this seminal political moment for yeah. you and for your family.
Right.
But even while you were doing Speech and Debate, were you kind of a politics kid as well? Were you thinking about that stuff?
Yeah, you know, I studied political science in college, but it was one of those things where I struggled with how do I contextualize the things I care about? Like, mm-hmm. how do I communicate that effectively through an artistic medium? You know, with storytelling, you have to have an arc, and with comedy, there has to be points where people laugh. Yeah. So I was like, how do I do this? I didn't know how to communicate that without just sounding angry or telling a story that's just really sad, yeah. you know?
Let's watch another clip,
okay.
and this is, your set at the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
Oh, okay.
It's from that.
Now, a lot of people think Steve Bannon is the reason Donald Trump dog whistles to racists. And that is just not true. Ask Steve Bannon. Is Steve Bannon here? I do not see Steve Bannon. I do not see Steve Bannon. Nazi Steve Bannon. Nazi Steve Bannon. Nazi Steve Bannon.
So it's funny, right? Like, I would imagine that, like, one of the funniest things about that clip is the abject mortification of everybody
else.
And I just wonder, I'd love for you to talk about the process of building that set. You were asked not to
Correct.
Roast the president because of his absence.
Right.
And just talk about what it took to craft a set that was so frontal about people that are in the most powerful positions possible in the country. I mean, how was
yeah,
that?
Yeah, so it was super, I mean, do you want me to start from like how I got the call? And like,
yeah, yeah.
Okay, so.
Yes, we
all right, so.
Second row
so,
wants it.
So Prashant, who's my head writer, he's here tonight. He was with me when we got the call. We were actually working on another sort of one-man show that I'm working on and developing. And I get a call from my agent, and he was like, hey, there's some interest in you hosting the White House Correspondents' Dinner. And I called Larry Wilmore, and Larry said something really powerful to me, too. He's like, are you kidding me? You're doing this. And he said, look, there's two ways to sort of protest and make a statement. There's people, you can throw rocks outside of the building, or you can do it within the building. And really, like, f*** some shit up, you
yeah.
know? And that Nazi Steve Bannon joke, that was candy. That was just like, let's have fun. You
yeah.
know, like that's a wordplay joke. But it's also, what's also, that happened pre-Charlottesville.
Right.
So I remember when we were workshopping it in New York, people were like, you can't say that, don't call him that, don't do that. This is way pre-Tiki. This is pre-Tiki. There's pre-Tiki and post-Tiki, right? This is pre-Tiki America. And the thing was, you know, the writers, everybody who worked on the speech, we really combed through every line because I knew that this is one of those things that would be documented mm-hmm. in history. You know, they will transcribe your whole set. So I didn't want any single line to be misinterpreted or you know. So I meant everything that I said, and I'm glad I said that joke, even though a lot of people were like, "Oh, you can't say that," or "That's not fair to say." And you know, post-Tiki, yeah, it's true.
It's true. So obviously that joke depends on an awful state of affairs.
Right.
Right? And
That's
I wonder.
So sad.
And I do wonder though, as needed as it is, whether you feel like in some way there's a sort of a perverse incentive for you where the weirder and worse things are, the more you have to talk
See,
about.
See, I don't like that.
I'm
this
just wondering. Yeah.
People are like, Trump must be great for your career. It's like, yeah, sure. More people are watching The Daily Show. But I would rather not have Nazis marching and I'll just write better jokes. You know what I mean? Like, we had great material even during the Obama administration.
There were jokes then.
Yeah, there's always been stuff to poke at.
Yeah.
So, like, that's just my position. You know, that's
right,
my take
right.
on it. Yeah.
And do you hold on to a hope that what you do intermingled as it is with your voice and your take and your bias, do you have a hope that it will help make things better? Do you?
Yeah.
Are you thinking of it as a positive force in that way, or is it just what you're doing because it's what you like to do?
I mean, when I was at the Republican National Convention and I was there, I mean, it felt like I was at Comic-Con for crazy people. Like, it felt like being in a haunted house, but all the lights were on. I mean, when you see 17,000 people being like, lock her up, doing this, it was crazy. It was crazy. I felt when I was there, look, I can't maybe convince the guy who's wearing the Trump that bitch shirt. I can't convince that person to maybe see my side, right? I can be empathetic, I can be kind, but make no mistake, I probably will not reach that guy. The person that I do think I'm trying to reach is, and this is very real, a lot of my friends that I went to college with, that I'm on like WhatsApp threads with, they're like, voting is dumb, being involved with politics is stupid, this has nothing to do with my life, I'm gonna watch the playoffs, you know,
right.
Like convincing that person who I know is smart, who works at Google or whatever, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Is this like, I know that there's a chunk of people that are just sort of on the fence, you know, mm-hmm. and I want to reach them to be like, hey, maybe think about this issue from a place of empathy and maybe it makes you do something, you know, hopefully.
Thank you.
That was comedian Hasan Minhaj with New Yorker staff writer Vincent Cunningham at the New Yorker Festival in 2017.